Asa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. This evening I've been asked to give a talk on the subject of the four jhanas. The four jhanas are the result of practicing samatha meditation. In order to understand the jhanas, it's helpful to understand the meaning of samatha. Samatha is the calming of the bodily and mental functions. That calming of the bodily and mental functions, stage by stage, step by step, leads to the jhanas. One can say loosely that it's an automatic process, in that if one is calming, going to ever deeper levels of calmness, one must eventually end up in the jhanas. However, in order to understand these different levels of calmness, it's worthwhile taking one through the various steps which eventually lead to the experience of the jhanas. And of course, one has to start way back at the very beginning. I mention this just in case people forget that one cannot expect to attain jhanas unless one's foundation is very secure and very strong. And that foundation, one can say, starts with one's virtue, one's morality. If one's virtue is lacking, then it becomes unlikely that one can enter a jhana. If one enters it, unlikely one can remain there very strong. Simply, it's like building a house, a very tall house without strong foundations. It wobbles and falls over very quickly. So in the practice of jhana meditation, one starts with virtue. The keeping of the five precepts for a layperson, the keeping of the Patimokkha rules for a monk, and as the Buddha said, keeping it to the extent that one sees danger in the slightest fault. Having achieved that purification of sila, then it becomes possible to achieve success in meditation, in samatha. And that link between the virtue and the success in meditation is usually described by the next step after virtue, which is the restraint of the sense faculties. Even in the Buddhist way of speaking, they even call this an aspect of virtue, indriya sangvara sila, the sila or the virtue which consists of restraining or guarding the sense faculties. And this restraint is the restraint of the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the bodily touches, and the mind. This restraint, as I read out the other night in the sutta reading, is not getting lost in the delightful or the aversion-producing signs of any sensual object. Any object which you perceive through these six senses will have usually an aspect to them which is producive of delight, or an aspect of them producing aversion. Quite often both are there in the object, but the mind chooses one or the other. The predominant aspect of that object. And if one does not, first of all, practice sense restraint, it means that the mind latches on to that which is delightful or that which is averse, causing aversion. And that will create the craving, will create the attachments, aversion in the mind. If one does not practice sense restraint, you will find that the mind will be turbulent because it is literally blown to and fro by the six senses. Having been blown to and fro for many hours, for many days, for many weeks, it becomes extremely unlikely that you'll be able to settle that mind down when you wish to in formal meditation. Indeed, one can say that the restraint of the six senses is a training in one's daily life, which bears its fruit when one sits quietly in one's meditation posture, watching the breath, or watching one's chosen kamatana or meditation object. This is a time where sense restraint really bears fruit. You will see from your experience that if you have not practiced sense restraint, those images of the senses will recur during one's meditation. What one saw in one's daily life, which one attached to, which one delighted in, or which one felt aversion to and created ill will towards, will find those objects quite often recurring and hindering one from attaining the result of tranquility, which is peace, which is eventually the jhanas. So realizing the importance of sense restraint, one practices that diligently as a foundation for the practice which eventuates in jhana. And one can also understand that sense restraint is a practice of samatha. Samatha being the tranquilizing, the calming of whatever. Here, by practicing sense restraint, you are calming the six senses. Having practiced sense restraint, the next preliminary foundation for the arising of jhanas is the establishment of mindfulness and clear comprehension. It's interesting in this gradual path that mindfulness and clear comprehension are not established at the beginning of the gradual training, but they are established here after sense restraint, which shows that the mindfulness and clear comprehension referred to by the Buddha is something quite profound, something which is taking that calming of the mind a little bit further than sense restraint. Indeed, when the senses are not restrained, that which we may call mindfulness or clear comprehension is only partial. It's only 50% or less or a little bit more, but it's not the full mindfulness and comprehension which is required as a preliminary for samatha meditation. The mindfulness is the function of the mind which clearly knows the content of consciousness. The clear comprehension of sampajanya is that wisdom faculty of the mind which knows what to do with that conscious experience. It knows its suitability, it knows its purpose, and so on. This is the function of the mind we call sampajanya, or clear comprehension. These two have to be established quite clearly, quite pronounced, before jhana can occur. And having established sati and sampajanya, the next stage is the abandonment of the five hindrances. Those five hindrances, once again, are karma chanda, or sometimes its synonym, abhijja. This is movement of the mind which seeks delight in the five senses: the sense of sight, the sense of hearing, the sense of smell, touch, or taste. It is that which seeks delight in the five senses. Be careful here that the hindrance, this first hindrance, only concerns those external five senses. That which seeks delight in the sixth sense, the mind, is quite an important help for the attainment of jhanas, because the attainment of jhanas is very much the delight in the mind, and one has to encourage that which seeks delight in the mind rather than delight externally in the five senses in order to achieve these jhana states. So be clear that first hindrance is not, as some people loosely translate, desire, or not as some people loosely translate, sensual desire. It is the sensual desire of the five senses, and in particular that movement of the mind which seeks pleasure in sights, sounds, tastes, touches, and smells. The second hindrance is vayapada, which is ill will. Ill will is not the same as aversion. Aversion is turning away from unskillful objects of the mind. Ill will is more than that. It's contemplating the hurt, especially directed to a being. Here, ill will has to be abandoned as the second hindrance. The third hindrance is tinamida, which is the sluggishness of the mind. It is the tiredness of the body. It is that which we usually call dullness or sleepiness. That too has to be abandoned before we can hope to attain a jhana. The fourth hindrance is one of the major obstacles to the attainment of jhana. It is called udaccha and kukaccha, which is restlessness and remorse. I prefer the term remorse rather than worry, because the term kukaccha is usually referred to the result of unskillful actions of body, speech, or mind in the past. It is remorse which builds up because of unskillful karma done by you, of a misdeed, of breaking one's precepts, of saying, doing, or thinking that which you should not have done. That remorse, that kukaccha, should be abandoned by those people who are very meticulous in keeping sila, in keeping the rules of the Vinaya, and keeping the rules of the monastery, and keeping general good behavior. But udaccha, the restlessness of the mind, is something which is harder to abandon. This is that which keeps pushing and pulling the mind around, which prevents it from staying still and remaining in one place. Udaccha is a habit of the mind. Now, that habit of the mind can often be motivated by the first two hindrances, either sensual desire, in other words, in the search for pleasure through the five senses. The mind moves first this way and that way, and is restless. Or through ill will and seeking ways to exhibit that ill will, the mind moves backwards and forwards. These are two of the greatest sources of udaccha, of restlessness. And the fifth hindrance is doubt. In particular here, it refers to the doubt about the path towards jhana, what one should be doing, where one is in this gradual training towards jhana, what one should do next, whether what one is experiencing is jhana or not, how close, or whatever, these doubts which keep asking questions of yourself during the meditation, which seek to know whether this is right, this is wrong, whether you should be doing this or should be doing that, this is doubt. And it is another cause for restlessness, something which disturbs the mind and stops it achieving full jhana. The way these hindrances are overcome is through choosing a kamatana, choosing a meditation object. The choosing of a meditation object has to be done according. The choosing of a meditation object has to be done according to one's personal traits, personal characteristics. The meditation object you use will not always be as successful to another person. However, here I wish to point out the meditation object of the breath, because this is the most common way which monks use to enter jhana. And by understanding the overcoming of the five hindrances and the arising of the jhana factors through the practice of anapanasati, or mindfulness of the breath, you should be able to understand the arising of the jhana factors using any other kamatana or meditation object. Again, having practiced virtue, having practiced sense restraint, having established sati and sampajanya, mindfulness and clear awareness, then one chooses one's meditation object, chooses the breathing. One thing which I was always impressed with was the little amount of information which the Buddha gave in the suttas concerning meditation, concerning the arousing of jhanas. Most people look for instruction for jhana meditation in the commentaries. And I always remember that saying of the Buddha. I think it occurs in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So it is a saying said by the Buddha at the very end of his life, saying that the teachings which he had given and which he had laid down and were remembered by Venerable Ananda were completely sufficient for every aspect of the training, for every aspect of the path, that he did not leave anything out which was necessary. And when I read that, then I started to look at not what the commentaries said about samatha meditation or the arising of jhana, but what the sutta said, what the Buddha said, and seeing how much one could gather from the Buddha's words. And if one looks at the Buddha's words, his instructions for a monk who is using the breath, his instructions which would give rise to jhana are contained in his description of the stages of anapanasati, of mindfulness of the breathing. And everyone should know that that first stage is just as one is breathing in or breathing out, to know whether it's a long breath or a short breath. And this meticulous, methodical approach to breath meditation is the most useful, is the most productive of attaining jhanas. In my own experience, I have found that when one approaches breath meditation unmethodically, skipping stages, skipping steps, doing it this way and that way, that one's meditation is really very effective. Sometimes you hit on the right thing by chance and achieve success, most often you do not. The methodical approach, the step-by-step approach as the Buddha taught it, is the one which I really recommend. So one starts just knowing a long breath or a short breath as one breathes in or as one breathes out. This is just getting hold of the breath, catching hold of it. From that one proceeds to the stage where one can clearly be aware of the whole breath. In the Anapanasati Sutta it says the body of the breath, and this is quite clearly meant to refer to the in-breath from the time it occurs all the way through till the end, the fading away of the in-breath, the out-breath from its beginning right through without interruption to the very end of an in-breath, seeing each in-breath, seeing each out-breath clearly without interruption. And this is that second stage. I like to call it the fully capturing your kamatana, having it clearly in your mind. Because unless the meditation object is clearly in your mind, you have nothing to calm. You have to capture your prey before you can train it. And so, once one has the meditation object clearly in mind without interruption, not just for a single breath, but for many breaths, one after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other, until one can be certain that that degree of restlessness which allows the mind to lose the meditation object and go off onto other trains of thought in the past or the future, that restlessness of the mind is abandoned, and you can very easily just watch the whole breath from beginning to end, breath after another, one breath after another. Only once you've reached that stage to start the fourth stage in the Anapanasati Sutta, which is to calm that breath, to calm the meditation object. Sometimes at the beginning of breath meditation you have to exert some force. You have to arouse chanda and virya, that which looks for, searches for, leaps towards the meditation object, and the virya, the energy thus resulting, which keeps the mind on the object. These two things can be looked on as supplying two of the jhana factors in a very coarse form. Those two jhana factors are called vitakka and vichara. The translations or renderings of those two terms by different authors is very different. From my experience, that it's quite clear that what vitakka and vichara mean in the realm or in the area of jhana meditation is that movement of the mind which pushes the attention onto the object, which inclines the attention to your chosen object. And vichara is that function of the mind which keeps it there. It's inappropriate to call that initial and sustained thought. It's much closer, much more accurate to call it initial application and sustained application. But again, you may know this as that movement of the mind which pushes or inclines or nudges or urges the attention onto the object chosen. And vichara as that function of the mind which holds the attention there, keeps it there, sticks it there. And these two factors are started to be cultivated even at this stage. To be able to maintain one's attention on the whole breath from the very beginning to its end, from the very beginning of the next breath to its end, requires this function of the mind, of vitakka and vichara, the initial or the pushing the mind onto the object and holding it there. You'll find that even at this stage, the mind not being settled will be liable to having other objects arise, such as thoughts, such as sounds, such as feelings outside of the breath. And that is why the vitakka and vichara are required here. As soon as the attention moves away, that which is vitakka pushes it back again, and vichara holds it there. And at the same time, when one is developing this ability to nudge the mind onto its object and to keep it there, one calms the breath. Calming the breath is achieved sometimes by just mere suggestion. You may call it an adhisthana. It is a suggestion of will to the mind to have the breath being calm. It can also just happen quite naturally, being that the longer one watches the whole breath, the mind quite naturally will become calm, and that will produce a smoother, calmer breath. At this stage in the meditation, once the breath starts to go to a certain degree of calmness, the mental image of the breath will appear to the mind. This mental image of the breath is very hard to describe because it appears to different people in different guises. It is just a perception in the mind relating to the physical feeling of the breath. For to some it might occur as a light in different forms, an imaginary light in the mind. To some it can still just be a feeling, but not so much a physical feeling as a mental feeling. To some it might be able to locate that at a particular part of the body. Quite naturally, where one locates it is nearly always at the tip of the nose somewhere, just above or just below. To some, one doesn't even locate it anywhere in the body. Being a mental object, it can just appear in the mind with no particular location on your physical body. But whatever it is, this will arise naturally once the breathing becomes sufficiently calm. It's as if that mental object was always there, but the grosser physical feelings hide it and cover it, so the mind is unable to notice it and perceive it clearly. Once that mental object appears, the mind quite naturally will want to be with that. Here, one has to resolve a very important doubt which might arise in the mind. And that doubt appeared to me as, what should I follow? Should I follow the breath, or should I follow the mental object? That doubt can be resolved by noticing, with the faculty of wisdom, that the mental object is indeed no different than the breathing. The mental object is just an aspect of the breath, just like the color red is the aspect of an apple. If one is watching an apple for long enough with a quiet mind, with an attentive mind, there are certain features of that apple will disappear and others will become more prominent. It may be that the shape of the apple disappears, its smell disappears, and all one sees in one's mind is the redness, and that becomes a prominent feature which one perceives. In much the same way, as the breath is going in and out, as it becomes calm, a prominent feature, the mental image of the breath, occurs. Allow the attention to stay with the mental image. The mental image is the gateway into jhanas. As one of the Buddhist texts says, and I cannot remember which, that a meditator who does not know the difference between the in-breath, the out-breath, and the mental image will never attain to jhana. Once that mental image is there, it takes an even more refined degree of vitakka and vichara to keep the attention on that mental image. This is a more refined state of mind, and so one needs more refined tools to keep the attention there. That nudging of the mind onto the mental image and the maintaining of the mind on that mental image is very important here. Again, these are functions of your mind. If you can notice them, that these are two different functions of the mind, that which nudges the mind once it moves off a little back onto the object is called vitakka. Once it's on the object, that which maintains it there, which keeps it stuck there, which holds it there, is called vichara. As one develops these two faculties and one achieves some success at keeping the mental image constantly in front of one, the factors of joy and happiness appear quite naturally in the mind. These are the factors called piti and sukha. Much has been said about what each one means, piti and sukha. The best definition does come from the commentaries, where it gives a simile of a man walking through the desert and from a distance seeing a body of water. Seeing the body of water from a distance, one gets the piti, one gets the mental rapture, and only after drinking that water, bathing, and resting under the shade of a tree by that lake does one experience the sukha. The sukha being like the ease of the body, the happiness which arises from the release of some affliction or whatever. In that simile, it is the release of the affliction of thirst and heat. The sukha which arises in this meditation and the piti which precedes it arises because of the release of the affliction of the five hindrances. Indeed, this practice, this process of methodically arousing the mental image and developing that which we call vitakka and vichara, to keep nudging the mind onto that image and maintaining the awareness there, can be said to be that which opposes and overcomes the grosser forms of the five hindrances and also the more subtle forms of those five hindrances. And piti sukha arises as a result. The piti sukha, even though I did mention there's a difference between them, one does not need to try at this stage to separate the two. Because at this stage in the meditation, piti and sukha are so close together, they're so intertwined, that it becomes very difficult for the meditator to really know which one is which. Even in the second jhana, it's very difficult to know which one is which. It's only in the experience of the third jhana, when half of these two twins, which look almost identical, disappears, the piti drops away, and all that is left is sukha, that one really understands what is meant by sukha in the context of jhana. Quite truly, it's only those meditators who experience the third jhana will know the difference between piti and sukha. So at this stage, it is helpful just to regard piti sukha as a pair, so close together that one might just regard this as one thing. And this piti sukha arises at this stage as a result of the overcoming of the affliction of the five hindrances. In particular, it is the overcoming of the hindrance which is the search for pleasure through the five senses. This search for pleasure through the five senses is a great affliction which we do not notice because we've been doing this all of the time. But the first time that the mind is free from this burden, from this tyranny of seeking for sensual pleasure through the five senses, the mind feels this amazing sense of inner peace, inner happiness, this inner piti sukha. It appears to the meditator as a very joyful state arising once the mind or once the attention manages to stay with the mental object for long enough. Now once that piti sukha starts to arise, one has to develop it. As the fifth and sixth stages in the Anapanasuti suggest, a monk breathes in and breathes out, developing piti and developing sukha. Thus he trains himself. Actually, the words in the sutta are, as he breathes in, the words in the sutta, if I remember them correctly, he says, I will breathe in experiencing piti, I will breathe out experiencing piti. Thus he trains himself. I'll breathe in experiencing piti, I'll breathe out experiencing piti. Thus he trains himself. I'll breathe in and breathe out experiencing sukha. Thus he trains himself. So one can understand here that one actually develops this piti and this sukha. One does that in the mind which makes it grow, which makes it become established. And at the beginning, that which makes it established, that which makes it grow, is just the action of vitakka and vichara on the meditation, on the mental object, on the mental image. That gives rise to piti and sukha. Another useful way of looking at it is that which keeps the attention on the mental object is also that which creates samatha, peace, tranquility in the mind. That vitakka and vichara is overcoming the opposite of tranquility, which is the restlessness, the moving away from the mental image onto something else, the swinging of the monkey away from the branch. So this is a more refined process of tranquilizing, calming, which we call samatha. So as we apply our attention onto that mental image, as we maintain that attention on that image, that piti sukha arise in the mind and grow and stabilize. At this particular stage, the piti and sukha become the main objects of one's attention. Just as when watching an apple, maybe the redness will disappear and the beautiful smell of it will become the most predominant characteristic of the apple. In this particular time, the piti and sukha become the most prominent object in the mind. And again, that piti sukha is a very joyful but peaceful feeling in the mind. When that piti sukha becomes firmly established in the mind, when it is stable, one can call that the experience of first jhana. The stability of this state is what I understand is meant by ekagata, gone to oneness. Gone to oneness, not in the sense of gone to a particular place, but a mind which is settled on one thing and which does not move away from it. Just as in the Buddha's simile of a monkey swinging from branch to branch, when the monkey, instead of swinging from branch to branch, stays on one branch, then one can say that he's gone to one branch. When the mind is settled on one object, in other words, that object is maintained from moment to moment to moment, over many seconds, over many minutes, sometimes over many hours, it is called ekagata, gone to oneness. Gone to oneness in time rather than gone to oneness in space. But even so, that sometimes for those who still have the mental image appearing as being located somewhere in their body, usually at the bottom of their nose, even then there is also the experience of spatial gone to oneness, being that all the attention has gone to one point, one physical point. So the gone to oneness is primarily a gone to oneness in time, a sustained attention which doesn't move from moment to moment to moment to moment. Although the gone to oneness can have this secondary meaning of gone to oneness in space. But that gone to oneness is not the primary factor of one's attention. One's attention, the primary factor is this piti sukha, this experience of joy and bliss, which is maintained from moment to moment to moment to moment, the stable experience. Now sometimes the arising of this stable piti sukha can occur quite fast. It can occur as a whooshing in of the mind, a falling in to somewhere, or it can occur gradually and gently. As it is occurring, there are two great obstacles which one should be aware of and remember. That first obstacle is called fear. The concentrated, peaceful, blissful state of mind, which we call jhana, sometimes arouses in the mind fear, as if that this is something too huge and powerful and awesome for one to handle.